You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today are Karen Frost and Diana Duvial. Karen Frost is a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, a Microsoft company. Previously, she spent 11 years working in the federal government as an analyst, but for the last 6 years, she has also been a freelance pop culture journalist. Diana Duvial is also a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. She spent 10 years as an analyst in the federal government. And I'm Caitlin Hopkins. I'm a threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. I have a master's degree in applied intelligence and have spent 4 years in analytic positions working for the government and private sector. Although all three of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Last week, we learned about the idea of gossip as unverified information. But Karen, didn't you say that some gossip does get verified?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that makes gossip interesting. We start with an unverified rumor, for example, that two celebrities are dating, and then often we get some sort of confirmation. A month later, they officially announce they're dating. Or there's no official confirmation. Maybe we see a picture in a magazine of them kissing on a date. Maybe they're on vacation. Later in this podcast, we'll talk about why neither of those things mean they actually are dating. But leaving that aside for a moment, yeah, most gossip sooner or later does become verified. And at that point, we might say it's no longer gossip, but fact. But let's drill deeper into this idea of verification, because that's the key to how we become better critical thinkers. Have you ever believed a piece of gossip that turned out to be wrong? Or the opposite, had a real nose for sniffing out the truth? Years ago, Philip Tetlock, a Canadian-American political science writer and professor, presented the idea of super forecasters. These are individuals who are particularly talented at making predictions. Tetlock found that the success of these super forecasters lies in how they analyze information. They gather information from multiple sources, they think through scenarios, and they learn from past successful or failed predictions. So while super forecasting is probably a somewhat innate ability, even the average person can improve their prediction ability just by being conscientious about tracking their predictions. Analyzing our past predictions helps us better understand our sources of information. Are they good or bad? And our own underlying assumptions and biases. It's kind of like a sports player watching footage of themselves. We can learn from our own mistakes and do better next time. We can train ourselves to be better predictors using anything, even gossip. Obviously, that's the whole point of this podcast, right? But how do we do this? The answer is by being curious about our predictions and following up on them. So let's say a popular magazine had reported that a celebrity was pregnant. If 9 months later there was no baby, we would learn from that experience. Perhaps the magazine didn't have good sources, or it purposely lied to increase readership. Maybe the celebrity herself leaked that fake information in order to get her name in the news. All of these things happen. And while we might not be able to identify where the breakdown in our analysis occurred, whether it was the equivalent of corrupted data or an analytic error, we would have our first data point from which we could eventually try to identify a pattern. A famous adage says, the truth will out. And when that happens, we can use the truth to train ourselves.
Okay, but there are times that the truth doesn't come out, correct?
Definitely. And those often become some of the more interesting pieces of gossip, at least for people who like a good conspiracy theory. So just to name a few that are popular, that are still floating around, regardless of how old they are, what happened the night that the actress Natalie Wood died? And what happened in the elevator the night rapper Jay-Z and singer Solange Knowles, sister of Beyonce, got into an altercation? Short of someone involved in those incidents writing the answer in an autobiography or providing some sort of a deathbed confession, the world will likely never know what happened. The truth in those cases won't out.
Okay, so what you're saying is that sometimes we can get an answer to a piece of gossip, but sometimes we can't, and sometimes we don't. But I bet what you're going to tell me is that we can use critical thinking techniques sometimes to try and get closer to an answer. Am I correct? So what is today's structured analytic technique?
Today, we're going to talk about timeline analysis, which is really just a fancy way of saying putting things in a chronological sequence. Now, there are several great benefits to using this straightforward, structured analytic technique. First, timelines are relatable. Since everyone's familiar with them, they can be a helpful tool when you're collaborating with a big team, or if you know up front that you'll be communicating your findings to a broad audience. Second, timelines can help us stay organized. When there is a complicated situation with lots of different actors or several events happening in parallel, arraying our information along a timeline can help us impose some order so we can begin to wrap our heads around what's happening. And finally, having a visual representation of complex events using a timeline can itself reveal trends or details we might otherwise overlook. This is one of my favorite things about structured analytic techniques, is how they can lend themselves to awesome visuals which help us process information better. So with timelines, for example, maybe there's an obvious gap in the timeline that shows we're missing information, or maybe we notice that something we assumed initially was causal is in fact out of sequence.
Okay, so if chronologies and timelines is our structured analytic technique, what is our gossip topic?
Fake celebrity dating.
Wait, hold on. Fake celebrity dating? Are you suggesting that sometimes people lie about who they're dating? I really don't understand why they would do that.
Actually, it's much more common than you would think. In fact, it happens pretty regularly. To answer the question of why, we have to put ourselves in some Hollywood shoes. Imagine it's the 1950s and you're a gay actor. Homosexuality is technically illegal in much of the United States, not to mention homophobia is rampant. If the public finds out you're gay, they'll refuse to watch your movies, and the producers and studios will never hire you again. So you marry a woman to provide cover. A gay person engaging in a relationship with a heterosexual person for the purpose of hiding their sexual orientation is often called bearding. Here's an old Hollywood example of bearding. Rock Hudson was one of the most popular movie stars of his time. His A-list career as a heartthrob lasted 3 decades. But when a gossip magazine outed him for being gay, he briefly married a woman to keep the general public from finding out. But bearding didn't just happen in the past. It still happens today. Some nationally and even internationally known celebrities, even A-listers, have been in fake relationships as a way to keep their sexual orientation a secret. But that's not the only reason they fake date. Another reason celebrities fake date is just for publicity. The public loves photos of celebrities on dates. So if 2 celebrities are single, they might pair up for an event in order to get some press. Although celebrities don't often admit that's what they're doing, sometimes they do years later. For example, and this is kind of old, I know, but Jackass star Steve-O once admitted that his 2006 fling with Nicole Richie was actually only publicity for her. They weren't really dating. And you can find PR agents also writing about this, about how they set up their clients in order to get them more publicity. They just don't tend to name them. What we're going to discuss today is an offshoot of this publicity dating. The idea of fake dating tied to movie ticket sales. As I said before, audiences love the idea that 2 romantic leads in a movie had so much chemistry that they fell in love in real life. And while this certainly happens, sometimes those relationships are faked to get audiences invested and increase ticket sales for the film.
Karen, this sounds like we're about to do some real sleuthing.
Well, what we're going to do is combine 2 separate chronologies, the big screen and DVD release timelines of the Twilight movie series, and the public dating history of the 2 leads in that series, Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson. Now, I want to say from the outset that we know nothing about their actual personal lives. We only know what was shown or what was announced to the public, which we know is rarely the full truth. But the reason I use this example is that I think that in this case, overlaying one timeline over another suggests that whatever was happening behind the scenes was likely not what was being portrayed in the press. So let's look at some dates and think about what they might tell us. The first Twilight movie was released in the fall of 2008. It was a massive commercial success. Fans desperately wanted to believe that the 2 young stars, Stewart and Pattinson, were dating. And by the summer, Stewart and Pattinson were publicly spending time together. This fan dating rumors and produced free publicity in the run-up to the second movie's release in the fall of 2010. When the 2 spent New Year's together in the UK, it was another great publicity bump right before the DVD release a few months later. For the next 2 years, the 2 kept a low profile, despite ongoing rumors. Were they dating? Weren't they dating? The few paparazzi photos of the 2 of them together were analyzed endlessly for clues by fans. Then, 1 month before the 4th movie's release, Stewart officially announced they were dating. And then, 2 weeks after the movie's DVD release, the notoriously publicity-shy duo attended a pre-Oscars party together. Throughout the summer of 2012, they went on dates while also promoting their 5th and final movie. But at the end of July, paparazzi obtained photos of Stewart kissing another man, sparking a public breakup. It was a public relations fiasco for Stewart. He was reviled in the press as a cheater. And yet 2 months later, right before the release of the final movie, Stewart and Pattinson publicly reunited. The relationship wasn't to last. 2 months after DVD sales started, they quietly broke up, this time for good. Now, I understand this is a hard story to follow. There are dates, there are events, there are insinuations and inferences, and there are informational gaps you could drive a truck through. To add to that, just because we're comparing the timelines doesn't necessarily mean there's an actual correlation between the events, much less causation. But maybe there is. Is the fact that Stewart and Pattinson reconciled right before the release of their final movie and broke up once the bulk of DVD sales finished a coincidence? Or does it indicate some sort of calculated PR move? What about the timing of the announcement that they were dating, a mere month before the release of their fourth movie? And then does the fact that Stewart publicly called herself gay on SNL in 2017 and then exclusively dated women after the breakup with Pattinson and is now engaged to a woman, does any of that matter? Does that suggest anything? We here at Gossip It are certainly not making any claim about anything. We don't know any of the people involved, and we know that love and sexual orientation is a complicated thing. But after comparing the two timelines, some online gossip sites at the time and later raised questions about whether this was a fake dating situation. Were publicists and agents using the Stewart Pattinson romance to lure young audience members into watching the movies and buying the DVDs? Or, if they were actually together at one point, did they pretend to reunite for the last movie? Perhaps we'll never know.
Okay, wow, that is really complicated. Diana, do you have anything from the tech world that might be a tad less complicated?
Less complicated? Probably not. But an example of how timelines are used in the tech world and in cyber threat intelligence in particular is something called attack timelines. The example I'm going to use is the SolarWinds attack. Unlike in Karen's example, in which she used the two timelines to suggest the possibility of hidden motives, in my example, we're using a single timeline to help us infer things about both the attackers and what the impact of the attack may be. For listeners unfamiliar with the SolarWinds attack, here's a quick background. SolarWinds is a major software company that sells system management tools for network and infrastructure monitoring. It has hundreds of thousands of customers around the world, including everything from Fortune 500 companies to U.S. agencies like Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, Treasury Department. In what's now called the SolarWinds attack, Russian intelligence hackers injected malicious code into SolarWinds Orion IT monitoring and management software as a way to conduct cyber espionage. What's important here is that as an IT monitoring system, Orion has privileged access to IT systems. This means that by hacking it, the Russian hackers basically hacked all the Orion customers at a privileged level. This is called a supply chain breach, and it's bad news for everyone. Now, this attack spanned over a year and was carried out in several stages. Timelines are best seen visually, but I'll do my best to give you a quick overview. Our timeline begins in September 2019, when the Russian hackers first hacked into SolarWinds. A week later, they injected test code into the Orion software and began a trial run. In November, they began to set up their attack infrastructure. In February, now 2020, they added a malicious backdoor to the Orion platform software update so that any updates the customers downloaded automatically contained this backdoor. By April 2020, these backdoors were being downloaded, and by June, the Russian hackers likely had reached enough interesting targets that they began to poke around on selected victim networks manually. And it was only in December 2020 that cybersecurity firm FireEye discovered it had been hacked and traced the attack back to SolarWinds. So here, our timeline doesn't just help us organize the data, all of those different dates, all those things happening. It helps us understand the implications of this attack. For example, we see that while an estimated 18,000 SolarWinds customers installed the malware-laced software update, probably only a tiny fraction of them were actually materially affected. This is because the hackers still had to move through the networks manually to conduct their cyber espionage. We also understand that for those customers, the hackers had at least 6 months to move through their networks undetected, stealing data. And as a final point, our timeline doesn't show any other cyber threat actors taking advantage of this vulnerability. The average time for a well-known vulnerability with working exploit code to be weaponized by other hacking groups is only 2 weeks. Think of it like this. A burglar finds that a house in the neighborhood has an open door, and within a few weeks, all the burglars in the neighborhood are breaking in. But in this case, the hackers were not only highly sophisticated and able to access SolarWinds through a method that even today is unknown, they didn't share this method of access with anyone else. They were selfish burglars. There's a final thing worth noting here. In some cases, a timeline might help us piece together evidence to identify the actor behind an attack. But in this case, attribution was never any question. The attack was conducted by a unit in Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. Today, that's called the SVR, but listeners may recognize it better as KGB. Specifically, the unit was APT-29, also called Cozy Bear or Nobelium. So although Cozy Bear took a year to carefully plan and execute its Solar Winds attack, within approximately a month of its exposure, we knew the group was behind it. So much for being sneaky.
Something to point out about the timelines and chronologies as a structured analytic technique is that it's diagnostic. This means we can really only do the analysis post facto, after the event. So for example, at the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we couldn't necessarily use timelines and chronologies because we wouldn't have all the data points yet. But let's say we wanted to assess whether the invasion was planned. Now, obviously, most of the world saw that it was planned. Russia wasn't particularly hiding its hand. But in the aftermath of the invasion, we can go back and look at various actions that the Russian government took. So for example, we could look at when Russia moved troops into the area around the border. We could look at which troops it moved when. We could look at the establishment of supply lines. We could even look at the ramping up of cyber attacks against Ukraine. At the time these events were happening, there could be multiple hypotheses for why Russia was doing it. Was Russia saber-rattling? Was Russia attempting to get Ukraine to stop talking about joining NATO? But obviously, after the event, we can see all of these things come together, and we see that Russia was definitely preparing to invade Ukraine and just looking for an opportunity and a cause, something they could hook into and not look like the aggressor. Although, of course, that ended up falling apart. But in this case, we can use the chronology to look at that. We also can do chronologies and timelines on when celebrities got pregnant. Now, this gets into the world of the conspiracy theory, so I don't want us to go too far down this road, but there is definitely a component within the gossip world of questioning whether some celebrities used surrogates and whether they admitted it or not. So certain people believed, again, that certain celebrities either faked the pregnancy entirely or used baby bellies to change the size of their belly to indicate a different timeline. One of the interesting examples of this, and one of the first examples of this, was actually when Katie Holmes was pregnant. For anyone that still remembers that time, she had just started dating Tom Cruise after dating Chris Klein. So there was some question among some gossip aficionados as to whether Suri, their daughter, actually was Chris Klein's, and that timeline was fudged. So again, an interesting idea that we can try and bring these things together. There were also interesting examples of people applying chronologies and timelines to the Kardashians. Because the episodes create storylines, they're not necessarily filmed in a way that's in order to the actual lives of the Kardashians. And so there are blogs that go through and recreate the actual timelines that these individuals experienced, whether they're incongruous or congruent with what's actually on the show.
Karen, that also makes me think of some celebrity gossip that I heard that Beyonce used a fake belly when she was supposedly pregnant with her child. And there was a clip of the belly supposedly deflating when she sat down in an interview.
Absolutely. And that's definitely one of the ones that comes up. You would have to look at the chronology and timeline on that. When did she stop flying? When did she stop eating sushi? These are things that people can bring into the picture. Again, there are so many things that we can apply that we might not even think of, where it's not just the chronology, it's other factors that go into the chronology.
Yeah, I guess you could use a timeline to show an increasing pace of something. So you could say, are these two countries, is their relationship increasing or not? And when you plot out what you know about their relationship over a timeline, you can see, oh, they had one meeting 10 years ago, they're the prime minister's met or whatever. And now every year they are having meetings, they're signing agreements. So it's in some ways almost like data analysis, like data bars going along a chronology to show increasing volume.
Or pattern identification, right? We're looking for what is the delta? Is there a change? Isn't there a change? What can we see? Let's say North Korea claims that it's not going to launch a nuclear weapon as a test run, but we see that they've started more activity at a nuclear site, and we can see that this is consistent with normally 6 weeks before a launch, they increase activity, something like that. It's often easy to think of a chronology as just something at the end of your research paper. As a college student, you have your, this is when this happened, and this is when this happened, and this is when the Declaration of Independence was signed. But again, we're looking for causality or correlation or change. And I think that's when we really start to get into that idea of analysis, where we go just from something that's a declaration of fact to what are this hidden secrets that we can derive from writing it down. And I think that's why sometimes these things are important that we write them down, because when they're in our head, it's hard to find those patterns. When it's on paper and we're arraying evidence, it's a lot easier to see these connections that might otherwise be hidden.
And I think that brings up the point of one of the pitfalls of using this technique is if you have spotty collection, then you have to be really careful about drawing inferences from it, because you could see this large gap in the timeline and think, oh, well, that means nothing was happening there. But just because you don't see anything doesn't mean that nothing was happening behind the scenes. So it's just like a cautionary tale that sometimes the visual could actually be misleading if you're not also thinking through what some of your assumptions are about your collection.
And as humans, one of our biases is the tendency to see patterns where none exist. So now we have that problem, the tendency towards finding causality and correlation where it doesn't necessarily exist.
Another example would be looking at the volume of North Korean attacks over time, especially as they're hitting financial institutions. And you can see as it's ramping up so much that it could signal a shift in North Korean policy of we're going to use cyber attacks to enrich the regime instead of just cyber espionage or that sort of thing.
Oh, I see what you're saying. We might expect to see an increase in cyber attacks anytime diplomatic talks between North Korea and the US go poorly. And then if a new cyber threat actor starts hitting banks, we might draw correlation to this is North Korea attempting to fill its coffers through illicit means as a way of going around sanctions.
So that would be a great, like if you had a question of, I'm a bank and things are going poorly with talks with North Korea, should I expect an increased attack profile right now? You could do a chronology analysis to be able to see how have attacks increased based on the tenor of relationships in the past. And that could give you some ideas for correlation moving into the future.
So what I'm hearing is you could use the timeline to identify drivers of behavior.
Exactly.
So I think what we see from this is that what starts off sounding like a really simple structured analytic technique actually has a lot of parts that go into it and a lot of lessons learned or analysis that we can derive from it based on what we're looking for. Are we looking to identify an actor? Are we looking to identify factors? Are we looking to identify informational gaps? Are we looking to identify hidden information that is a pattern or just hidden in some other way that we think a chronology might reveal? For example, one of the things that has turned up in the news lately is the hypothesis that maybe Russian President Vladimir Putin has cancer. Now, obviously, we don't have very good insight into President Putin's movements, but let's say we did, and let's say that a few times a week he went off the grid. We might be able to calculate that when he goes off the grid, he's getting chemotherapy. So again, there are some ways that we can also take that informational gap and then attempt to hypothesize what that gap is telling us in the absence of any other way to find that information. Again, we can't verify it. He could be going to see a mistress or something else, but we can use that to infer additional information.
There are at least 66 structured analytic techniques. While chronologies and timelines may not seem to be a particularly important technique compared to some of the later techniques we'll discuss, it absolutely has its place when conducting diagnostic analysis. As we've said today, it can help us understand motive, identify informational gaps, and even reveal what's formerly termed denial and deception, but that we as laypeople might just call attempts to deceive. In this podcast, we've applied it to cyber issues, world politics, and celebrity dating, and even, tangentially, women's biology. The key to using a timeline effectively is to write it down and think about both what's visible and invisible.
The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called analysis of competing hypotheses. What if one of the world's top pop stars dated a supermodel and left clues for fans everywhere? Or did she? And on the tech side, we'll be discussing Elon Musk's plan to colonize Mars. Find out all this and more on the next episode of Gossip Int.